The National Broadcasting Company presents Lives of Great Men, a new series on great leaders in human progress, presented by Dr. Edward Howard Griggs, distinguished lecturer, critic, and author of a book of meditations and many other books. In his talks, Dr. Griggs is building a story of civilization based on outstanding characters through the ages and how each one influences his own and future time. This evening, Dr. Griggs will discuss Browning, the friend of the spirit. We present now Edward Howard Griggs.
My friends, to the confused thinking and bewildered striving of our time, Browning is peculiarly tonic and challenging because of his unswerving faith in life and an optimism that comes after and not before the facing of struggle and suffering. He was less interested in surface movements of his time than in the eternal elements of life. Not only is he a permanently great poet and thinker, but beyond all others, a friend of the spirit, interpreting those aspects of personal life, the developing and refining of which should be the chief boast of our effort. The unhappy youth of Browning's father, forced to become a London bank clerk instead of the painter or poet he aspired to be, led him to dedicate his son to poetry from the start. Browning's tender and pious mother was the daughter of a German shipper who had settled in Scotland. Born in 1812 in Camberwell, then a prosaic suburb of London, Browning was chiefly tutored at home in an education of nutriment rather than discipline. Early he showed love of nature, especially for active animal life, and developed his passion for the Greeks, which was to last lifelong. At 14 he discovered Shelley, who became his ideal, deeply influencing his early work. Pauline, which Browning thought he had destroyed with other early poems, is a fragmentary autobiography of his restless youth. In Paracelsus, published at 23, he plunged into the deeps of ethical and psychological problems, giving an impressive portrayal of the youth of genius and of the relation of a leader to the world. Browning had early ambition to become a dramatist for the stage, and his Strafford, and a few years later A Blot and Escutcheon, were more successful than could have been expected when we consider that he did not have the true stage instinct. Thus, in his 20s, he was recognized as one of the promising young poets of the day. The tide turned at 28 with the publication of Sordello, which had occupied him for several years and involved a trip to Italy to view all the places associated with Sordello's life. The poem was a great study of the poet's struggle to become man and master of faith, but was unfortunate in poetic method and demanded for its appreciation a knowledge of the most confused period of medieval Italian history. Browning was, moreover, opening new paths in poetry in advance of the taste of the time. In Pippa Passes, he portrayed the interweaving of lives in a series of dramatic moments united by the influence of Pippa's passing song. In the dramatic lyrics published in Bells and Pomegranates, he gave evidence of discovering that the dramatic monologue was the natural vehicle for expressing his dominant interest in crises and chapters of soul development. Thus he lost his audience, and for the 20 years forming the center of his creative life, had to go on working with only a group of disciples and friends to respond. The important point is he did go steadily forward, never doubting his vocation as poet, sure that his work would win in the end whatever recognition it deserved. This shows Browning's strong affirmative character, but it resulted also from the supreme personal experience of his life, of which the story is told in the precious Browning letters. Elizabeth Barrett was a half dozen years older than Robert Browning, and her poetry was much closer to the taste of the time. An accident in her girlhood, complicated later by lung trouble, had made her an invalid, rarely leaving her room. The invalidism was accentuated by her family environment, and particularly by the attitude of her father, who considered her hopelessly ill. Browning met her through his friend and her relative, John Kenyon, to whom he expressed his warm admiration for Miss Barrett's poetry. Kenyon suggested that it would please her if Browning would write his appreciation and send it to her, which he did enthusiastically. He received an equally warm-hearted answer with high praise of his own work. So began the two volumes of letters, revealing a love that helps us to believe the best is still possible in the highest relationship of personal life. Early in the correspondence, Browning asked to come to see her. She was fearful and reluctant, writing, "There is nothing to see in me, nor to hear in me. If my poetry is worth anything to any eye, it is a flower of me. The rest of me is nothing but a root, fit for the ground and the dark. He insisted, and she finally consented. At the first meeting, Browning knew that he had found his life's answer. Almost immediately, he wrote to tell her so. She returned the letter, telling him never to refer to such a thought again on pain of breaking their friendship. Her feeling, of course, was that she had no right to burden his virile, forward-looking life with her deaf-mear invalidism. Browning burned the letter, but went straight on with the masculine wooing. Gradually, he won her to turn on the path which she thought led so short a way to the brink, where stood the angel of the darker drink, and take from Browning's own strong hand the cup of life and love. It is a beautiful story. The woman side of it she told in those unmatched sonnets she modestly entitled From the Portuguese. The marriage had to be an elopement owing to the obsession of her father against the marriage of any of his children, and especially the one he regarded as a bedridden invalid. He never forgave her, to her sorrow, leaving her letters unopened. For the wife's health, and because both loved Italy, the Brownings journeyed on to settle in Casa Guidi, Florence, just around the corner from the Pitti Palace, for the 15 years of wedded lover life, with occasional visits to Rome, other Italian places, Paris, and London. Browning's two previous visits to Italy had wakened in him a passion for Italian art, of which he became the great interpreter. He called Italy his university, and with her unequaled wealth of art, of human and historic association, what a university it was, for what a student. During the Florence period, he wrote Christmas Eve and Easter Day, showing his struggle with the religious problem. But the great work of those years, containing many of his best poems, was Men and Women. The two volumes are rich in those brief, dramatic moments where Browning is at his happiest, and include exquisite personal poems revealing the great experience, such as The Guardian Angel, written some months before his son's birth, and By the Fireside, interpreting the supreme moment when two lives become one, and imagining an autumn of life with the beloved companion, which, alas, he was to be denied. The epilogue, One Word More, tenderest and most exalted of personal tributes, was his answer to Mrs. Browning's sonnets from the Portuguese. Men and Women also revealed his complete mastery of the dramatic monologue. In such profound interpretations of character as the poignant Andrea del Sarto, the gay but searching Fra Lippo Lippi, and in the characterization of epochs of culture in Cleon and a Toccata of Galuppi's, the much and wrongly criticized Child Roland to the Dark Tower Came was included in the volumes. It approaches the imagist type of poetry and is a portrayal of the unconquerable human will in sheer heroism facing despair. The studies of sex psychology, such as Any Wife to Any Husband, A Woman's Last Word, and In a Year, displayed a new depth of insight into the mind and heart of the woman, fruit of Browning's own love relationship. The birth of his son, idolized by both parents, completed for Browning the trinity of family life. A legacy from John Kenyon, added to Mrs. Browning's small inheritance, eased their financial problem. Browning had brilliant humor, delighted in playing jokes, and eagerly seized as a therapeutic measure every opportunity to make Mrs. Browning laugh. Harriet Hosmer, the younger American sculptress, who became an intimate friend of both husband and wife, tells, among several amusing incidents, of a wild ride she had with Browning in the borrowed donkey cart of Girolamo, peddler of green groceries, catapulting the vegetables in all directions as the donkey raced stableward. On getting home, Browning, with boyish mischievousness, reconstructed the entire adventure, giving Mrs. Browning her most exuberant fit of laughter. No one can appreciate Browning's full and rounded humanity without recognizing this aspect of abundant humor. Browning was 49 when his wife died. He went sadly home to London, never revisiting Florence, and returning to Italy only after 17 years. But though his own life was shadowed, he never lost faith in the sunlight. His attitude is expressed in the last line of Caponsacchi's monologue, "O great, just, good God, miserable me." Slowly the roots of his life were reestablished, and he took up his work again. In the golden years in Florence, he had found on a second-hand stall that old yellow book, part print, part manuscript, documents of a Roman murder case of 1698. Now he resumed study of that material, and out of it wrought his masterpiece, The Ring and the Book, a dozen long dramatic monologues telling one story over and over. The unifying image is that the older goldsmith took gold from the mine, mixed it with alloy, and molded it into a ring. Then a spurt of acid, and the alloy was gone. It was gold, it is gold, but now a ring to carry a sentiment and seal a marriage. So Browning took from the mine of life pure, crude fact secreted from man's life when hearts beat hard and brains high-blooded ticked 2 centuries since. With it, Browning mixed the alloy of his creative spirit and made the book. It was fact, it is fact, but now truth, fact interpreted in relation to all life. Each telling of a story thus tests the character speaking in moral reality and depth of experience, since to see truth, one must be true. From the maligned Guido, through the representatives of public opinion and of the legal process, the poem rises to the portrayal of Browning's ideal man and woman. Caponsacchi, the worldling transformed by love into God's man, and Pompilia, earth's flower, she holds up to the softened face of God. Unique among literary masterpieces, The Ring and the Book contains Browning's whole philosophy of art and truth in relation to life. In the late period, Browning turned to the Greeks, as foreshadowed in By the Fireside, and made the classic world live again in Glossian's Adventure and Aristophanes' Apology. With these longer works, a wealth of briefer poems came in the late years, some in ballad form, and many showing his delight in experimenting with bizarre metrical and rhyme form. In the last period, he returned to Italy, living for a time at Asolo, scene of Pippa Passes. There he wrote tender retrospective poems, gathered them up with others, and issued them in his last volume, Asolando, published on the day of his death in 1889. His clinging to the great experience on which his life centered is shown in a bit of verse called Speculative. Others may need new life in heaven, man, nature, art made new assume, man with new mind old saints to leaven, nature, new light, the clear old gloom. Art that breaks bounds gets soaring room. I shall pray, fugitive as precious minutes which pass, return, remain. Let earth's old life once more enmesh us, you with old pleasure, me old pain. So we but meet, nor part again. The last months were spent in his son's palace on the Grand Canal in Venice. His son's wife, an American, by the way, tells of his reading to them the epilogue to Asolando, his final confession of faith, and remarking that some might consider the third stanza egotistical, but he had decided to let it stand. It says that he was one who never turned his back, but marched breast forward, never doubted clouds would break, never dreamed though right were worsted, wrong would triumph, held we fall to rise, are baffled to fight better, sleep to wake. Splendidly affirmative in life and thought, Browning rose to every call. As his life centered in the great love experience, so his interest as artist was in portraying those moments in the development of personality which call out all that a character has been and make the potential life actual. Browning was too wise to clothe his wide range of characters in one poetic form. But if art is adequate and harmonious marrying of the body of expression to the soul of meaning, he was a great artist. He has created a world of characters that live permanently and given us a gospel of life as growth ever onward on the basis of truth with the crown of love.
Browning, the friend of the spirit, has been the subject of another program in the series titled Lives of Great Men, presented by Dr. Edward Howard Griggs, distinguished lecturer, critic, and author. Next week, Dr. Griggs will speak on Tolstoy, Moral Leadership in Mysterious Russia. And copies of tonight's discussion of Browning, the Friend of the Spirit, may be obtained by addressing the National Broadcasting Company in Radio City, New York, or the station to which you are listening. This is the National Broadcasting Company, RCA Building, Radio City, New York.